Yes.
Last year I was speaking with a devotee about humility, and I was thinking like if a devotee is a pure devotee and he's a realized soul, then he's not identifying with his body, but he's identifying with his self, and the self is pure. And because it's connected with Krishna, then he understands that he's a servant of Krishna. And then there is an aspect of humility in that relationship. But then we see like many, many examples of exalted souls who they say that they are so conditioned and they are so fallen, but they can't be fallen or conditioned, because if they really identify with the soul, which is pure, they can't feel that they are fallen and conditioned. So that is a kind of like different kind of humility. So I would like you to like explain like what is exactly this humility, and also like if this humility, this kind of like self-destructive humility, can be dangerous for our spiritual life.
My explanation would be somewhat theoretical, because to explain the psychology of an exalted soul, you have to be one. So, but anyway, I can try. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu himself says, "Na prema gandosti darapi me haro krandami." What is this? Sabhagya bara prakashitam. So I don't have even a little smell of prema, of love of God. And if you see some tears in my eyes, it's just a show of my fortune. I will just try to show off that see I'm so fortunate. So what is there in the psychology of a great soul? Why do they feel themselves so low? Because this particular emotional quality is being experienced when one feels the separation from God. Because the identity of a pure devotee is not so much of a soul. You can say that jnani or yogi is trying to to have this clear identity as a spirit soul. But a pure devotee, his identity is somewhat different. They do feel that they're spirit soul, but the emphasis is not that they're spirit soul, the emphasis is they're part of God. And at the same time, when they feel separation from God, they feel that they are kind of away from God. And this moment, this feeling of doinya, or a feeling of complete, utter humility, that I don't have anything to do with God, and that's why I'm fallen, appears in the heart. So it's something like this. They feel they're part of God, but at the same time they feel that they're separated from God, and that's why this feeling of uselessness is there, or the feeling of... It's actually normal human psychology. Even today I spoke in a lecture for Russians that when we feel separation with somebody whom we love, there is a very strong connection between you, very strong emotional bond, but due to some reasons you are separated, then the humility comes as a natural outcome of this feeling of separation. So humility is at the same time feeling of being very small, infinitesimal part of God, but also others, because when devotees are with Krishna, they don't feel them fallen. In a meeting, the feeling is different. This feeling of utter humility is the experience when one feels separation with God. That's my two cents into this thing. It's natural because, first of all, you feel that you are part of somebody, and at the same time you feel that you are a separate part, and this feeling of separation brings about this kind of emotion, so to speak. It's like, you know, if you have a finger. You know, if a finger is all of a sudden separated and thrown somewhere, you feel very humble in this position. Quite useless too. Did I answer your question? Yes.
I have one question regarding the class today morning. From somebody else more than me. Because that person felt a bit distressed afterwards. Because if we didn't speak in depth, but what I got from the person was like, okay, my life was not as ideal as you might have described it. Like, it was not happy family life, it was like marriage wise and the whole chaos, and it's like, and the person that doesn't feel properly situated, but at the same time it's like, what can I do now? It's like quite late and the life feels all messed up, so can I still make spiritual progress, or am I like...
Spiritual progress is possible from any condition of life, and it's perhaps I didn't emphasize it enough. Spiritual progress is possible, and that's not a prerequisite, but the point of the class was that it's easier to do spiritual progress if you're properly situated. And I must say that, you know, the situation in the world is far from ideal. And to apply this high standard is unrealistic. And more or less everyone is in this mess, which is called Western civilization. And everyone is confused. Nobody knows what is his identity. And, you know, we have to, you know, how Prabhupada used to say, we have to make the best use of a bad bargain. You know, this is the bad bargain from the beginning. We have to try to use it to maximum capacity. So just start wherever we are, but at the same time, not neglect kind of material side, because if we totally neglect, and this is a mistake of some perverted forms of spirituality, when people are trying to negate completely material mind and material body, this negation, you know, you ultimately will have to pay a very high price for this, but. You know, if you're a devotee and if you're doing okay, and you know, it doesn't matter. What Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, he makes a very interesting point. He says that bhakti is not dependent on the material environment or material situation you're in. Absolutely not. But he says, if the material situation or environment is not conducive for your bhakti, then the practice of bhakti shortens your life. That's what Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, and he gives an example of Jesus Christ or the Pole. He says that if the surrounding is not conducive, ideally, you know, there is a smooth transition, so to speak. Bhakti is anyway, it's not really very smooth continuation from material life. You have to depart from material life anyway. But if the material situation is conducive, then this departure or this breach is more like, it's not so drastic. But if you have to practice bhakti in a very hostile environment, and by hostile environment I don't mean the external environment. Hostile environment can be the environment of your own mind. You know, you practice bhakti, and bhakti is a practice of a soul. But if the mind is kind of not very conducive or hostile, basically the Svarnashrama is the culture of the mind. It helps people to cultivate the mind in such a way that it becomes, it becomes auspicious, or it becomes favorable for cultivation of bhakti. That's it. And if the mind is not favorable for cultivation of bhakti, you still can practice bhakti, but it will be a little more difficult. That's it. And I definitely didn't mean to make anyone distressed.
Yeah, no, it's just perception.
No, but it's there, but at the same time, it's not 100%. It's not an absolute necessity, but it helps. And that's why Prabhupada stresses this point, and Bhaktivinoda Thakur stresses this point.
Mm-hmm. Maharaj, I was wondering if you could maybe say something about relationships and like friendships and different. Because as students, we have to deal a lot with having relationships with seniors, juniors, peers, and like maybe.
So you're more interested in the relationship with the seniors or with the peers?
I guess peers.
See, any relationship is based on a sacrifice. There is no relationship without sacrifice. If you're not planning to do any sacrifice for somebody else, there won't be any meaningful relationship in your life. And the deeper sacrifice is, the deeper relationship will be. In other words, you have to really, you know, give up something, some part of your interest or ego or whatever. And usually we are not trained in this kind of relationship. Of course, it's still very natural for mother to sacrifice herself for the sake of the child. And the more she sacrifices, the deeper the relationship, at least from her part. It is a known phenomenon that if the child is sick, you know, if the mother has many children and one is very sickly, you know, she loves him most. Why? Because she invested most of her time, energy, and love into him. The service was more or less, you know, invested into him, and therefore the relationship grew deeper in this situation. So, you know, we have to very clearly understand that we are by nature very egocentric, and the Western environment creates this egocentricity in people. But relationship means that I leave my egocentric situation in the center of the world as a pole star around which the universe is rotating. And I kind of invite somebody else into my world, and this is not just a world where I am in the center. So, the relationship deepens, and by sacrifice I mean many different things. Sacrifice, of course, can be on a physical level, but it can be also on a more subtle level. Like, for example, you know, we like to speak. Everyone likes to speak, and if I sacrifice my propensity to speak for the sake of listening to somebody, that's already a big sacrifice. So, in other words, relationship is based on this ability to give. And if I am programming myself to give and to giving something to other person, the more I give, the deeper will be my relationship with him. And this is the way to experience some emotional security, because when people are trained to do this, they are very secure emotionally, because they get everything. Like you can see very, very glorious example of Radhanath Maharaj. He's just giving. He's always giving, giving. Sometimes you feel painful, you know. He gives so much, you know. Sometimes feel, you know, is there anything left for himself? But there is a lot, because he gets as a result of this. As a result, he gets so much also. You know. So that's the way to establish relationship. Just program yourself on giving, and you will get more than you need. Also, that's how reciprocation works.
If you would like to tell us something about the sadhana, and we notice how sadhana, when we hear from, like, if you could tell us from maybe from perspective of your own realization, because when somebody is practicing something for a long time, then there are certain realizations which come, and then when one hears, it becomes actual, one shares. So, and connection with going deep in a relationship with Krishna, and the necessity of having sadhana, and how to actually, you know, make it personal.
See, the very word sadhana means the practice for achieving certain goal. And the problem with the sadhana is usually the same, you know, when people lose the perspective of the goal but still engage in the sadhana becomes meaningless. Sadhana loses its quality of being sadhana, because sadhana is only sadhana when the goal is very clear. When the sadhya is very clearly established in the mind, then only the practice can be called sadhana. Otherwise, when the goal is lost, when the perspective is not there, then it's not sadhana, it's just a ritual. There is a subtle difference between ritual and sadhana. Ritual is something which you do just by the way of habit, because everyone is doing, because there is some social pressure upon you, and so many other reasons can be there for this. But some practice becomes strong if you keep focus on the goal of this. And therefore we have to be reminded all the time and remind ourselves about the goal of the practice. And then, you know, what else can I say about sadhana? Sadhana is easy if it's practiced every day. You know, you can stay on a certain level without any problem, but if you unstable, therefore actually Patanjali Muni makes it Vyasadev in commentaries to Yoga Sutra. There is a sutra in Yoga Sutras which explains what is sadhana or what is abhyas. Sanskrit word abhyas, as you may know, comes from the root as, which means to be, to exist. Abhyas. Abhyas means to repeat, basically. Abhyas means repetition, to come into the same state of being, same kind of state, again and again and again, or in the same condition. But Vyasadev, commenting on the sutra about abhyas, what abhyas is, he stresses the point that that the main point of the sutra is yatana. Yatana means sadhana, is the repetition with endeavor. Yatna means you try, you endeavor, you invest some vigor into it, some endeavor. And Vyasadev, if I remember it properly, he says that what is this endeavor? What kind of endeavor we have to invest? And he says endeavor in this particular case means enthusiasm with some energy, with some shakti. Enthusiasm is a main point there. Enthusiasm, which... Anyway, this is what sadhana means. Sadhana means you see the goal and you apply some endeavor, some force, some enthusiasm. And then it's not boring. If it's a ritual, mechanistic ritual, when you lost the perspective of the goal and you're not trying anymore, really. You're just doing it just because you're supposed to do it. Then it's not sadhana. And it becomes a very useless exercise in the ultimate sense of the word. But sadhana is very nice because you're regulated. If you're regulated, your mind is very clear and very, apt. And it's easy, and ultimately it becomes very pleasant. In the beginning, you have to really force yourself to get up early and change your habits. But ultimately, it becomes very pleasant. Because in reality, mind likes rules. Mind, when there is no rules, mind becomes totally confused and just, and even though we may feel like not having rules, but in reality we do like rules. And the more regulated the environment is and our life is, the more we like it. And it's good on all levels, on a physical level, on an emotional level.
My question is about Jnana Mishra Bhakta. If our nature is, if we are really enjoying to study, to explore different philosophies, comparing it to our own, and is it a sense of mind gratification? And how far should we go into...
It's not Jnana Mishra Bhakta. Jnana Mishra Bhakti, your process becomes Jnana Mishra Bhakti if your goal is really liberation. That's a prerequisite for the lifestyle or for the process to be called Jnana Mishra Bhakti. So you mix bhakti, your goal is not love of God, you just want to be liberated, you just fed up, had it enough, and that's why you're doing it. But if you like, see, the study of the scriptures, it's not jnana. It's a big mistake to call this jnana. Jnana is a specific process. Study of a scripture, it can be bhakti, if your goal is bhakti. It can be jnana if your goal is jnana. But if your goal is really bhakti, then it's bhakti, and you can compare, you can go deep, you can explore different philosophies. There is no harm in it. It doesn't really, doesn't really touch us, or doesn't really, English, I started again in English, but anyway, it doesn't really degrade the quality of your bhakti. Your bhakti is still bhakti if the goal is bhakti. In fact, Srila Prabhupada says that anyone who wants to be acharya, he has to know six systems of Vedic philosophy, which have nothing to do with bhakti. But if you take, for example, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, he sometimes quotes Yoga Sutra, in his commentaries or whatever. He's definitely knowledgeable of other systems. And he just studies different systems of philosophy from the point of view of bhakti. And it's not giving. It's not giving. It's just a fertile mind, you know, it has to be engaged nicely.
But then the pleasure of, when we serve devotees, like when, for instance, there are devotees who can make nice preparations and serve devotees by cooking and doing something else, serving prasad, I mean, they really enjoy it. And there's not much of a, it seems not much of mercy coming from the Lord just by studying. Or is it, it's really like...
Well, you can cook your lectures. By mixing different things. And if you do it properly, it will be enjoyable for the Lord as well. It's also some sort of preparation which you can make for His offering, just saying, you know, this is for you, my Lord. It really depends on how you treat this process. It can be very devotional because you know, if you prove that actually each and every philosophy is glorifying the Lord in the ultimate sense of the word, what more, you know, can be called bhakti? Like there was a disciple of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur Prabhupada, godbrother of Srila Prabhupada, Professor Nishikant Sanyal. His name was Sudhakar something. I don't remember. He was very dear disciple of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur Prabhupada, so much so that he even mentioned him in his last minutes of his life. He basically gave all his possessions to the mission, Gaudiya Math and everything. And he was a philosopher. He was a great philosopher. I don't know if you read his Sri Krishna Chaitanya, his two-volume book. He knows all the philosophies, and but his ultimate point is that, you know, Sri Krishna Chaitanya is the pinnacle of all the philosophers. And in fact, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu himself was a philosopher, and he knew, at least Nyaya, he definitely knew. And he did use it, maybe not so extensively in his emotional years, but still. So there is no harm. The point is that, this is the point which I was trying to make during today's lecture, we have something, and whatever we have has to be properly engaged in the service of the Lord. If we have some intellectual capacities, these intellectual capacities have to be engaged, you know, and if you have the intellectual capacities and you just only cook prasadam, that's kind of nice, but and you may get pure love of God through this process, but sometimes you may need to read something else. And also the study of the scripture is called Svadhyaya, as you know. And Svadhyaya means self-analysis. So by studying scriptures and different philosophies, you ultimately understand yourself and God. Answer to this question, I would be very happy. The point is that we, you know, it's a gradual process. You cannot just do it like this. You can just turn some button in your head and you become selfless all of a sudden. Just show me the button. I will push. You know, it doesn't work like this. You know, we're selfish because we have material body and material mind. The very nature of the body is selfish. And the mind is also selfish. You You know, the human being, the little baby, he's selfish. You know, there's no agenda of becoming selfless. You cannot be a selfless baby. You will die immediately. So, you know, it's a condition of the body and the mind. You can only ultimately become selfless if you transcend the conditioning of the body and the mind. Because the nature of the soul is to give, is to love, is to be selfless. But in our state of consciousness, we practice selflessness by serving others. And by serving others, we get some experience, some emotional experience, and we understand that experience is deeper when we don't expect anything. And by the way of experience, you kind of, you know, you go in this direction more and more and more. At least theoretically, we have to understand that we want love and only love. And this is the definition of love. Love should be selfless. There is no selfish love. It's not love. So if we understand that we want love, and this is the only experience which will really satisfy us. Anything less than this will not bring satisfaction. So we can practice and strive for this, and you know, it will be through the trial and error we will learn something. So and we're basically you know, we're doomed to have some selfish motivations, even though sometimes we're not aware of these selfish motivations. We still calculate. Mind is there's a great calculator. It just calculates many, many steps ahead. But when you transcend the mind and when you really become soul, then only you get rid of the selfish nature. But you know, if you practice and watch yourself and try to be selfless, then you get something. You get something very, very deep emotionally. As far as other people are concerned, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he gives a nice point. He makes a very nice point. He says that if you realize that you are part of God and you are His servant, then you will relate to other human beings also as a parts of God. You will also understand this. If you realize your own nature, then the real compassion will be there, and the real compassion means selflessness. So we are selfish because of ego. And ego makes us feel separate from everyone else. And the only way to work with ego is to, first of all, make the ego proper, which I was talking today in the lecture, you know, to make the ego healthy, so to speak. And also, and then gradually reduce it, reduce the false ego through the way of service. And then, you know, done, and you will like it. It's actually much more fun to be selfless than to be selfish. And there's nothing special in being selfish, but there's something really special. Because we all want to be special. That's the way to become special.
Thakur, it gives this explanation of surrender as avoiding that which is not good for your devotional life, devotional service. But then, on the other hand, we have this kind of like, we hear it over and over again, you don't stay in your comfort zone, you know, stretch a bit, but then on the other hand, how do we know what is dangerous for our devotional life and what will help us grow? So how can we make
So your question is whether you're pushing yourself too much and giving something up, which is not really...
Yeah, which is not beneficial for your...
Well, the explanation which he gives is interesting. He says that how to find a balance in this, in any processes of surrender. He says the balance, you know, if it's too easy and you become complacent and lazy and you do something which is, you know, which is less than what you could do, you will feel boredom. And if you do something which is too much for you, really over your head, you will feel miserable. You really will feel miserable. I've seen people who were trying to follow very high standards, and you know, just look at them and you see this something is wrong with this person because he's not happy. So he gives a nice definition. You know, if you're stretching yourself as much as it gives you some challenge in your life. And gives you some fresh challenge, you know, when you have some fresh challenge in your life, you feel enthusiastic and nice. But at the same time, you know, it's not too much so that you just become really miserable or pain is there. You know, it's like in yoga, if you stretch yourself too much, you know, because of your ego, you try to, you know, really, then you will get severe pain and ultimately you will injure yourself. And if you're too lazy, you just do this, then, you know, it's no fun. You get bored. The real yoga, the experience of yoga is that you stretch yourself as much as it's a little painful, but not too much painful. And you feel that, you know, there's some enthusiasm is coming from this pain. So, this is a very good definition, that there should be some stress, some pain, some endeavor. Some pain should be there, but little pain when it's still pleasant. The pain when it's not too much, it's pleasant because it wakes you up. So if you're not sleepy and if you're not really screaming out of pain, but you just awake with little pain, it's fine.
But in such a way we can expand our limits.
Yeah. This is the way to expand our limits, yes. This is the way. Otherwise, you just stay in a very limited condition where you are in. You're in Maya. This Maya means you're limited. Okay. Hmm? Yes, yes, please. Yeah, but see, in the third canto, where there is a description of universal form, it is said that the varnas appear from the universal form. First, the occupation appears from the universal form, and then the particular mentality appears from the universal form. And even though we definitely have mixed tendencies, we still have some tendencies which can be developed. You know, how to treat this question is that, yes, we have mixed tendencies, but, you know, I still have some tendencies. If I apply force in developing certain tendency, which is already there, then I can still consider myself as properly situated. And it's not that they're mixed in each and every case. Some people are very clear-cut cases in terms of their mental makeup or psychological tendencies, but most of the people, they don't know. It's not that we mixed. The problem is not that we mixed. The problem is that we're not aware of our own tendencies. we are not really directly in touch with ourselves, and because we get so much, you know, mixed signals, and you know, everything is so confused in Kali Yuga. That's it's difficult. You cannot, you know, it's not that in previous ages people were, the natures of people was much more pure. It was pure, but there was some mixture as well at that time. However, there was a stress in the society and some kind of social pressure for you to develop certain nature which is there in you. And if you develop and perfect the certain nature which is there for you, you are still properly situated, your mind is satisfied. And it's just a question of finding this nature which you should develop to be happy throughout the life. That's it. So anyone still has the tendency, the same, because it's a creation of God. And it's very interesting, this is the last thing which I say, because in the third canto, where Vidura, or Maitreya explains to Vidura this universal form and how the varna, different varnas appeared from the universal form, he glorifies each one. He says, Brahmanas are the best because they are the head, they are mukhya, the main. He says, Kshatriyas are the best because they protect others. And he says, Vaishyas are the best because only Vaishyas can feed others. Nobody else can feed, you know. Vaishyas is the only one who can make money. But then he comes to Shudras and he says, but the real best one is Shudras. The real best one. And he says, specifically, he says, why? Because their occupation, their nature is service. And by service, the Lord is pleased. He doesn't say, Lord is not necessarily pleased by philosophical Brahmanas because they can become, you know, proud and selfish. So, if nothing else, we can always serve, and this is the best occupation anyway. We can develop this nature, which is there, and it's the most glorious nature. Ultimately, it is the most glorious nature because Srimad Bhagavatam specifically stresses this. How to say, vrittayah tushyate hari. Hari is satisfied by this vritti, by this occupation, which is there in the Shudras. This nature everyone has. So we can at least perfect this nature and then we are properly situated. Okay, I guess we have to part now. Thank you very much for taking this course in Bhaktivedanta College. It's we're very fortunate. As I said yesterday to Yadananda Maharaj, I become really fortunate next lifetime I can become a student in Bhaktivedanta
College. You still have time, Maharaj.
I don't think it's possible this lifetime.
I'll give you a discount.
I'll consider it.
Maharaj, thank you for